Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Ultimate Goals of Life, Equanimity, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami.
Good morning, everyone. The Master Course is starting over. Oh, I chose lesson one, which is actually yesterday's lesson. Gives a nice sense of what the Master Course is all about. This part is the merging with Shiva part first. Never have there been so many people living on the planet wondering, what is the real goal, the final purpose of life? However, man is blinded by his ignorance and his concern with the externalities of the world. He is caught, enthralled, bound by karma. The ultimate realizations available are beyond his understanding and remain to him obscure, even intellectually. Man's ultimate quest, the final evolutionary frontier, is within man himself. It is the truth spoken by Vedic rishis as the self within man, attainable through control of the mind and purification. It is karma that keeps us from knowing of and reaching life's final goal. Yet it is wrong to call it a goal. It is what is known by the knower to have always existed. It is not a matter of becoming the self, but of realizing that you never were not the self. And what is that self? It is Parashiva. It is God. It is that which is beyond the mind, beyond thought, feeling and emotion, beyond time, form, and space. That is what all men are seeking, looking for, longing for. When karma is controlled through yoga, and dharma well performed, and the energies are transmuted to their ultimate state, the Vedic truth of life, discovered by the rishis so long ago, becomes obvious. That goal is to realize God Shiva in his absolute or transcendent state, which when realized is your own ultimate state, timeless, formless, spaceless truth. That truth lies beyond the thinking mind, beyond the feeling nature, beyond action or any movement of the vrittis, the waves of the mind. Being, seeing this truth, then gives the correct perspective, brings the external realities into perspective. They then are seen as truly unrealities, yet not discarded as such. This intimate experience must be experienced while in the physical body. One comes back and back again into flesh simply to realize Parashiva, nothing more. Yet the self or Parashiva is an experience only after it has been experienced. Yet it is not an experience at all, but the only possible non-experience, which registers in its aftermath upon the mind of man. Prior to that, it is a goal. After realization, one thing is lost, the desire for the self. So that's a pretty high-minded way to start out. That's our first lesson, right? So obviously, it's talking about something that's very advanced, but yet Gurudeva has put it at the beginning. So in preparing for classes for the coming Inner Search, I ran across this in some of the old material, which explains the idea of putting such a high-minded goal first. Gurudeva says, seeing God in the unmanifest state, the pure Advaita, as I talked to you about in the Master Course, is the end of the path after all of the other requirements have been met. That set the ultimate goal in your mind. But now the arduous achieving of that goal must be continued as we lay the foundations to build a bridge across five abysses. An analogy to the Sanmarga path. A platform at the top of the hill upon which to meditate in preparation to walk the third world Sanmarga, the straight path, and merge into God. So this is useful. The idea being that it's important to have the ultimate goal in mind, even though it's a bit distant from us. Similar to starting the first grade and thinking we're going to graduate from high school. We have the goal in mind. We know that we're not there. What we're doing isn't totally related to the ultimate goal, but we're headed in that direction. And the foundations are what, or make sure, what we need to make sure are in place. David says, as we lay the foundations to build a bridge across five abysses. And if you don't recall the concept of the five abysses, it's the opposite or the negative of the five darshans or shaktis of Lord Ganesha. So you take the first shakti or darshan is harmony in the home, or for the monks, harmony in the monastery. So the abyss is inharmony in the home. Harmony among friends and relatives is the second shakti. Inharmony among friends and relatives is the abyss, so forth. So it's a talk in itself. But the idea is we need our life in a harmonious condition. We need to have conquered these challenges. Challenges in life are getting along with other people, right? Somehow that's more difficult than it seems. But having harmonious relationships with others is the foundation or what we need to have in place for the more advanced practices, practice of meditation, for example, to be fruitful. Otherwise, we practice meditation and then something goes wrong in our relations with others and our meditation falls apart. So we're only as strong as our weakest point. So we need to make sure all the foundational work is in place in a good way before we can expect the more advanced work to be sustainable. Now that's what Gurudev was talking about here. And I always enjoy this one, the idea of a non-experience. The only possible non-experience which registers in its aftermath upon the mind of man. What does it mean to call something a non-experience? Well, it means the experiencer is temporarily not present. You can only have an experience if there's an experiencer, right? I am seeing the fire. So if the I am isn't present, there can't be any experience of the fire, right? So the I am is the awareness. So we need awareness to be present to have an experience. If awareness is not present, then it's a non-experience. So that's one way of explaining the realization of Parashiva, is it's the temporary absence of awareness. And then when awareness reforms, in the aftermath of the experience, you have a concept that there was a realization. But during the non-experience, there's no concept or experience. Anyway, something to think about for those who enjoy those kinds of reflections. Right there in the first lesson, one of the most advanced concepts. Looking at the lesson one from Dancing with Shiva, it's not as high-minded, not as advanced. Rishis proclaim that we are not our body, mind, or emotions. We are divine souls on a wondrous journey. We came from God, live in God, and are evolving into oneness with God. We are in truth, the truth we seek. So I have a standard talk on the Purusharthas, the four goals of life, Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. most of you have heard me give it. So I usually go through kama and artha, wealth and love, and then I go through dharma or virtue. And then I make this point before I get to moksha. I say, I found a way to put an audience to sleep in 5 minutes. Do you know what it is? And then I say, it's to talk about moksha for 5 minutes. Guaranteed. You know, we all know it's right there. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha. It's the fourth one. It's important, right? It's one of those four purusharthas. But if a Swami talks about it for 5 minutes, the audience will lose interest. It's always happens. So why is that? Well, it's a fair thing. I mean, that the audience would lose interest is perfectly natural. It's not inappropriate. It's because it seems so distant. It seems so far away. It seems like something for monks in a cave to worry about moksha. You know, here I am in the middle of life, and I've got all these challenges, all these problems I'm dealing with, and problems with the kids, problems at work, and where do I have time to think about moksha? Good point. But if we don't think about moksha, we're missing the point of the whole process. Dharma, artha, and kama are not ends in themselves. They're supposed to lead to moksha. Or as we read in our first lesson, we're supposed to, from merging with Shiva, we're supposed to lead up to realization of the self is the goal. So therefore I say, well, instead of talking about moksha, let's talk about the journey to moksha. And that catches everyone's interest. No one falls asleep. The idea being that we're on the journey toward moksha. So, you know, if we'd imagine a mountain with a winding paths are easier to walk up than straight ones, right? So winding path, the top is moksha. And each lifetime, ideally, we're moving toward the top. Through what we do in life, we're moving forward. We're not standing still or we're not going backwards. So if during our lifetime we're moving forward in this journey toward moksha, that's called spiritual progress. If we're standing still, that's not spiritual progress. And if we're involved in adharmic activities, if our karma is heavy and we're not seeing life right and we're doing things we shouldn't, then we're actually going backwards. We're leaving life with more karma than we came into life with. And of course, that's not good. We want to move forward. Well, as long as we're moving forward as much as is natural to us in any one lifetime, then we're doing what we should. We're making progress on the spiritual path. So that's what Gurudev is talking about here. We are souls on a wondrous journey. So that's what we need to always keep in mind, the journey, and make sure through reflection now and then that we're actually making progress by the way we're living our life. And then after I go through a long talk about spiritual progress and how we make progress, which I'm not going to mention this morning, but at the end I always say this. As it can take many lifetimes, remember to enjoy the journey. Life is meant to be lived joyously. So that's an important point, is sometimes we get burdened by the journey, the difficulties we're facing along the way, and we're not as joyous as we could be. We're not striving to face our karma in a joyous way. We're letting it discourage us. We're letting it take the joy out of life. But we don't want to. We want to live life joyously and enjoy the journey. Smell the flowers. Enjoy the sunshine. Enjoy the friends. Enjoy our family. And then we're approaching it in the right way. And our living with Shiva one fits right in. It's called Awakening Comes Slowly. Fits right into the topic, right? So we have to be patient. So I'll just read the last part. My Satguru Siva Yogaswami was a great Siddha, a master and a knower of God. He would say, liberation is within you. He would order his seekers to see God in everything. You are in God, God is within you. To realize the Supreme Being within you, you must have a strong body and a pure mind. As we go on through life, we only see parts of life. We don't see the whole. Yoga Swami said, how can a part see the whole? So we live with a small part. We seek to avoid the painful areas and attract to us the joyous ones. Occasionally, someone breaks out of this cycle and asks a deeper question. Who is God? Where is God? How can I come to know God? God has no names, but all names are the names of God. Whether you call him this or that, he remains who he is. But in our tradition, we call God by the loving name Shiva, which is one of his 1,008 traditional names. Supreme God Shiva is both within us and outside of us. Even desire, the fulfillment of desire, the joy, the pain, the sorrow, birth and death, this is all Shiva, nothing but Shiva. This is hard to believe for the unenlightened individual who cannot see how a good, kind, and loving God could create pain and sorrow. Actually, we find that Shiva did not in the sense that is commonly thought. God gave the law of karma, decreeing that each energy set into motion returns with equal force. In looking closely at this natural law, we can see that we create our own joy, our own pain, our own sorrow, and our own release from sorrow. Yet we could not do this except for the power and existence of our loving Lord. Shiva is there as the soul of each soul. You can open your inner eye and see him in others, see him in the world as the world. Little by little, discipline yourself to meditate at the same time each day. Meditate, discover the silent center of yourself, and then go deep within to the core of your real being. Slowly the purity comes. Slowly the awakening comes. So definitely one of the challenges is facing that which comes to us in life. And certainly the philosophical understanding of the nature of what comes to us is very helpful, which is what we were just reading, that we've created it. It's not anyone else's creation. What we're facing is the karmic reaction to something we did in the past, in this life or a past life. There's no one to blame for what's going wrong except ourselves. There's no one to praise for what's going right except ourselves. So we know that philosophically, right? That's not a new statement. The hard part is when things are going wrong, to remember it and to apply it. We tend not to. If things are going well, it's easy to remember, oh yes, this is my good karma. You know? But when things are going poorly, we don't in the same way say, oh yes, this is my negative karma. I wonder what in the world I did to create this mess. You know, we tend not to think that way. It's human nature to want to blame someone else, to think it must be somebody else's fault, or certainly if someone else had done something differently, or if my parents had done something differently, then this wouldn't have happened. It's my parents' fault. Must be. They're an easy scapegoat, right? But of course, it's not our parents' fault. It's our fault. And the easy thing is when someone mistreats us is we get upset with them. But as I like to say, if it wasn't that person, it would be someone else. That karma has to come through us, through somebody. If it wasn't our parent, if it wasn't our brother, our sister, it wasn't this person, it wasn't our employer, it wasn't our partner, it would be somebody else. We're destined to experience that. Unless we do extreme tapas and get rid of it, which is rare. It can be gotten rid of, but it's hard. So for most people, it's easiest to say we're destined to experience it in one form or another and accept it as our karma. So to accept it as our karma, as I say, is easy right now, but in the middle of a difficulty, it can be hard to do, but that's what we need to do. And then I found something interesting through experience. When we call something a problem, say, oh, I have a problem. I have a big problem. That makes it harder to deal with than if we didn't call it a problem. If we just said, well, this is the next thing to deal with. Why call it a problem and make it harder to deal with? Call it a big problem, we want to avoid it. Whereas it's just the next thing we have to do. It's the next thing we have to do. I remember in counseling someone, they apologized. They said, I'm so sorry to bring you this big problem. And I said, well, don't worry, but you know, if you look at it mystically, you know, I didn't want to tell them that because it wouldn't make sense at the time. It's in my karma to hear their problem, right? I wouldn't sit there and hear their problem unless it was in my karma to hear it. So actually, I should thank them for bringing that problem to me so I can hear it and get rid of that karma. But we don't think that way, right? Our children misbehave, and we have to figure out how to correct their behavior. We think it's a problem. But it's in our karma to experience that misbehavior and to have to figure out how to respond to it. Otherwise, it would never happen. But we don't tend to look at it that way. We tend to label things problems or misbehaviors. And therefore, we don't face them with the same joy, the same enthusiasm. We face something that's not a problem. But they're both there to face. So if we can not go to such an emotional extreme in reacting negatively to some challenging situation and reacting too joyously in some abundant situation, then we handle life better. So definitely, next time you hear yourself saying the word problem, think about it. This is a problem. Why am I labeling it a problem? Why am I not just labeling it the next thing to do and facing it and working through it? One last thought. Liberation comes. This is one of two definitions Gurudeva gives for liberation. Liberation comes when all our karmas are resolved, Dharma has been fulfilled, and God has been realized. Well, that's a wonderful definition because it's threefold. Quite often when you talk about liberation, you just talk about realizing God. And you have this concept, you know, someone sitting under a tree, lightning strikes, and they're realized, and they've achieved moksha. This is the storybook concept of moksha, or liberation. Well, realization doesn't come in that way. Realization is gradual, just like anything else in life. But liberation, or moksha, has two other parts to it. One is resolving karma. And the other is fulfilling Dharma. So fulfilling Dharma is the idea that, say for example, going through school. You go through high school and then you go through undergraduate study. After your undergraduate study, you get a bachelor's degree. What would happen if you tried to go back to high school? You wouldn't fit in, right? Everyone would say, "This, you can't be here. You already did this. You already know this. You're too mature. This is for those who haven't gone through the university." So that's the idea of fulfilling all our Dharma. Once you've done everything, you really can't go back and try and do it again. It doesn't work. You fulfilled Dharma. So we need to fulfill joyously where we find ourselves in life. Is our Dharma. Resolving karma, we talk about that a lot. That's when karma comes to us, we have the option of accepting it or not accepting it. When we don't accept it, we retaliate. Someone mistreats us, so we mistreat them back. There's a retaliation, so we've created a new karma. I use the number system. You know, we come into life with 100 karmas. Someone mistreats us, we're down to 99, right? This is good. Then we retaliate back, we're up to 100. We missed an opportunity there to stay down at 99 by retaliating. So it's very important, and Gurudeva stresses that, and the Tirukkural talks about that a lot, is, you know, don't retaliate. And it even gives a more high-minded approach. It says, if someone mistreats you, return that mistreatment with kindness. Punish the person by making them ashamed of what they did. Instead of punishing them in a retaliatory sense, let them be punished or feel bad by realizing the mistake of what they did, because you return their negative action with a positive one. So that's why karma is so important. It relates to moksha. Oh, there's a lot there in the first lesson of the year. Okay, we have flag raising in a few minutes, I guess. Symbolizes starting a new season. So this season starts with, the seasons start with where the sun is. So the sun, when the sun goes into Aries, it's a new season. It's a good time for planning. Best time of year to plan is this month. Excellent time for creating new plans. Guru Davis suggests everyone have a multiple year plan, and at this time of year you revise it. You add another year to it. So if your plan is 3 years, you add another year. If it's 6 years, you add another year this time of year. Okay, we'll have a nice flag raising in a few minutes. Om Namah Shivaya. Om. Awakening on the path of enlightenment is to separate awareness from that which it is aware of. Important idea, which we're all familiar with. There's another aspect to the practice of meditation. It is learning to hold the peaceful, blissful, insightful inner consciousness that we attain during our morning meditation throughout the various tasks we perform during the day. Said another way, the idea is to remain centered in inner consciousness no matter how challenging the tasks we are performing, no matter how stressful the situations we are in. The English word that conveys this idea is equanimity, which is defined as the quality of remaining calm and undisturbed, evenness of mind or temper, composure. Equanimity implies an inherent evenness of temper or disposition that is not easily disturbed. Another definition of equanimity is steadiness of mind under stress. Related word is imperturbable, not easily perturbed or excited or upset, marked by extreme calm and composure. There's a verse in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras on this concept, chapter 1, verse 33. It says, the projection of friendliness, compassion, gladness, and equanimity toward things, be they joyful, sorrowful, meritorious, or demeritorious, leads to the pacification of consciousness. The Sanskrit word for equanimity is upeksha. The idea of the sutra is that equanimity is one of four qualities needed so that we can maintain inner peace through all types of situations. There's an excellent definition of upeksha. Where else but Wikipedia? Wikipedia is amazing amount of material. It says, as a spiritual value, upeksha means equanimity in the face of fluctuations of worldly fortune. It is evenness of mind, unshakable freedom of mind, a state of inner equipoise that cannot be upset by gain and loss, honor and dishonor, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. Gurudeva elucidates this idea in chapter 16 of Merging with Shiva. He begins by talking about being centered. What does it mean to get centered and to be centered? Actually, what it means is to feel the primal source within, to feel so centered that you are the center. And we always are something of what we feel, our hands or our legs or our bodies or our emotions or our desires. Most people on the path have the desire to get rid of their desires. It's an impossible battle. Have you ever tried to get rid of your desires? If you would stop trying to get rid of your desires, then you would be centered, because you take the energy out of desire. You take awareness away from that world of desire, and you get right in the primal source of the energy which flows through the physical body. It flows through the emotional network, right through the intellectual mind. That primal source of energy is flowing through the spine in each and every one of us this very moment. Feel it? The entire spiritual unfoldment process, oddly enough, is designed to throw you off center so that you have to work to pull yourself on center. First, life throws you off center. You have all kinds of experiences. You make mistakes and with your indomitable will have to control that fluctuating awareness to get it right on center and be all right right now. Feel that powerful energy flowing through every nerve current and be that energy rather than the fluctuating nerve current. Then one day, when you really get good at it, you find a guru. You are firmly on center, and he tries to throw you off center. My guru Yogaswami would always throw his disciples off center and set them spinning. They had to work hard with themselves to get on center again. That strengthens the sinews and the muscles of man's becoming himself, becoming totally aware that he is aware, and then controlling his mind by not allowing his awareness to get caught up in the vast illusion of the externalities of the mind. How's that? That's a good one. The vast illusion of the externalities of the mind. So that's the end of the quote. The basic idea being that the greater control over awareness that we achieve in our daily actions translates into greater control over our awareness when we meditate. The two aren't separate. So the guru is trying to help you strengthen that ability by throwing you off center. So when I read that story, I remembered a story Gurudeva told, and its wonderful feature. We're working on the Guru Parampara book, and it's a searchable file, so I can find things. So I looked up the word saws, S-A-W-S, saws. Came right to the story. It's the only reference to saws in the whole book. So it's the story about saws. Gurudeva's fourth catalyst was Dayananda Priyadasi, who lived in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Gurudeva gives a lengthy description of his training with Dayananda. And here's the first portion of that description. It's a very nice story. My fourth catalyst taught me how to use the willpower, how to get things done in the world. He was a real father to me. I needed this at 21 years of age. I wanted to meditate, but he wanted me to work to help the village people in reconstructing the rural areas. He assigned me to do different duties, sometimes several at a time, which I had to work out from within myself. One, seeing that a new village bridge was put up that had been washed out in the flood. Another, bringing into a village modern saws and carpentry equipment to replace traditional tools used in building furniture. So it's the furniture story here. I had to take a survey of all the carpenters using hand saws on the west coast of Sri Lanka. I went around with a notebook and listed all their names and addresses and the types of saws they were using. For my assignment was to see that they all would eventually be provided with electric saws. Getting modern equipment into the Moratua area was one of the biggest assignments I had ever had. I had no idea how to begin, for I had never done anything of this nature in my life. Sounds like he's getting thrown off center. Huh? Occasionally, my catalyst would ask, well, have they gotten their saws yet? All I could say was, well, I'm working on it. Executing governmental changes was strange to me. My life had been quiet with no exposure to methods of business. But even worse, I was in a foreign country that had different customs, subtle ways of relating and suggesting. Most of the educated could speak English beautifully. In the villages, however, only the native languages, Sinhalese and Tamil, were spoken and understood. The craftsmen were accustomed to the old ways, their father's ways of making furniture, and were not easily persuaded that electric saws would improve their work. Some had grown up in remote regions where there was no electricity, no running water. So naturally, they resisted such a massive change. They made good, sturdy furniture already. Why complicate life further? They must have thought. My natural shyness was the biggest barrier, though. Imagine Gurudeva being shy. My natural shyness was the biggest barrier, though. I had to interview people, do research, and convince people of the practicality of electric equipment. Finally, it unfolded to me from the inside how to go about it. I drew up an elaborate proposal, long and wordy, with myriad details, diagrams, names, and addresses. I gave it to him, meaning his catalyst. He was pleased and said, now, what I want you to do is take this fine proposal to the head of the Department of Rural Reconstruction. You give it to him, and I will do the rest. But while you are in his office, sit down with him and tell him how fast work is done in your country by using modern equipment to make furniture. I was happy. At last, I had something definite to do that would bring this project to a successful end. I went into Colombo to the Office of Rural Reconstruction and presented the proposal. The government was convinced, and not many months later, the modern electric saw became available and popular in the Moratua villages for any carpenter who needed one. Sri Lanka had just that year received its independent dominion status from the crown, and there was a lot to do to bring the rural areas up to better standards. I did my part in the best way I knew how and was glad to do so. One assignment like this after another was given to me. This fourth catalyst of mine worked on the philosophy that you do what you're told. If you are given an assignment, do it to perfection. Finish it and don't come back with excuses. If he sent you on a mission, you wouldn't dare return until you had completed that mission. Not to your satisfaction, but to his. He might have nothing more to do with you if you had failed. I knew that, so I was very, very careful. Inside myself, as I struggled to do tasks that seemed impossible, I could hear him saying, don't fail, don't fall short. You create the obstacles. You can overcome anything, do anything, be anything. He challenged me to work out problems from within myself, offering little advice and often assigning a task and then just leaving. He was quick to point out my mistakes, even though he knew I was sensitive and couldn't stand being scolded. Still, he scolded and criticized harshly. This was good for me, and I am still thankful for his direct and powerful ways. He made me use my own inner intelligence to complete each assignment, and most of them were of a worldly nature. At this time in my life, that is exactly what I needed, to strengthen the outer shell, to learn to accomplish duties in the world. It was invaluable in later years. End of story. Isn't that a great story? Findable by searching on the word saws. Oh, to remind us of the idea that I mentioned at the beginning, since the story is so charming, we can forget. But we were defining yoga at the beginning, and the definition we gave is, yoga is controlling the flow of awareness throughout the day. Thank you very much.